Welcome to Sonic Talk number 362. If you were around last week for the live show, I'm terribly sorry. I was at a wedding. In fact, I was having lunch at apparently one of the top five restaurants in the country, the Manoir Quatre Saisons, which is Raymond Blanc, which was very nice indeed. Congratulations to our friends Catherine and Mark, where they got married. Anyway, but I hope you enjoyed the interview with Axel Hartmann, who was very kindly came on and talked about his design philosophy and all that kind of stuff. So we're back this week. We are live. If you wanted to know what that's all about, we've got a live chat room, which I will now show here. Live chat room. You can see me and it. I probably need to wiggle my... Yeah, if I move my camera a little bit, then I'll be in shot and... Yeah, there we go. You know what I'm saying. So thank you very much for listening. Obviously, Isotope are our sponsors, and we have the winner of a competition 2 weeks ago. So I didn't set a competition this week. But you will also get the chance to win Isotope Iris again. And you might find that you've won this week. Well, you probably won't win twice, because that would probably... We should probably put something in rules about that. Anyway, I'm rambling. It's probably time for my guests to see me straight. So I'll go over first to Mr. Robbie Bronneman over there in Robot Studios. Robbie is, of course, musical director. Well, probably more music MD for Howard Jones at the moment, because he's about to head off on tour and has been putting the rig together. And hopefully we'll have a little look at that later. He sent a video, so I'm really looking forward to showing that. Robbie, how are you?
Very good, thanks. Yeah, I'm just glad that all the cases and all that stuff's out of the way, because I've been just up to my eyes in dimensions and all that kind of business for the last 2 weeks. So it's been very boring.
Oh, what a nightmare. Well, not a nightmare. It is a nightmare, but yeah. It's like planning a patch bay, but ultimately satisfying, because you're going to get to use it. It's got to be right, okay?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, yeah.
We're going to see a little bit of that later as well, I hope. So cool. I'm quite excited by that. And also, we're coming in reverse order, just four down to one. Rich, you are in position three this week. Rich Hilton, of course, chic keyboardist and Nile Rodgers' personal studio guy. Very, very busy still, I'm sure. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
I see you're going to be playing in Ibiza. I just saw something week. Come up. Next week. Wow,
next
rocking.
Week. Yeah, yeah. But first, we go to Paris this weekend.
Ah, where do you play in Paris?
At a festival called Montereau.
Ah.
It's about an hour outside of Paris, actually.
It's not Montreux as in the deep,
as
the
in
classic
Switzerland,
deep...
No, and forgive my sketchy interpretation of the French language.
Well, that's all right. I hope you have a lovely time. Does that mean you won't be with us next week? Or are you gonna
Let me think. I think I'm traveling, the 11th? I'm not looking at a calendar.
Oh, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter.
I
want to put you on the spot.
I check my flight time.
Okay.
Wednesday is the day I'll be leaving.
Ah, okay. Well, maybe not. Maybe not. Like I say there, as the notice in the chat room, that they spotted your subtle product placement of Electron. Today is a bit of an Electron day, because, of course, we posted the history of Electron that we shot with Jenk, a.k.a. Dataline. If you want to have a look at some SID station right up through to Analog Rhythm with all the stuff in between, then do check it out. I posted it live on the site. Seems to be doing very well. And Rich, you're flying the flag for Electron too. They do make quality garments.
I'm very pleased with the shirt, and they're very nice people.
I've never been able to afford an Electron T-shirt. They are just... Anyway, I won't go into it, but they are pricey garments, but quality. So let's have me coming back through. We've got number two, Mark Tinley. You're a little bit low in your frame. Perhaps you could just tilt yourself somehow so that we can see. You've gone a bit pixely as well, but I'm guessing that's your bandwidth. Hopefully it won't affect your audio. Mark Tinley, of course, creative thinker, sound artist, and kitchen broadcaster. How are you, Mark Tinley?
How is that? Do I look all right now?
You look fine, if a little pixelated, but we'll just have to work with it. Anyway, how are you, Mark? You well?
I'm all right. Yeah, I don't know why I'm pixelated. I don't think we're doing anything.
It's just
dramatic.
We occasionally
son's playing Minecraft.
We occasionally have a bad Skype day, don't we? It's just the way it goes. So, but anyway, thank you for
joining. How am I? Oh yeah, how am I? I'm all right.
Good. I'm glad to hear that too. And Will, I'm coming straight back here to Mr. Gaswold Williams of Bristol, bass playing, music production, mastering, kind of all about music technologist kind of guy. How are you, Mr. Gaz?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you very much. I played a gig at the weekend with the classic dance band The Egg.
Ah, yes, I remember them.
Who played live dance, sort of like a kind of trancey sort of techno, but it's like a proper band. So it's really quite interesting to do. But I have to say, I think I did one of the naughtiest things possibly in the history of music technology. I played, because I was playing my MIDI bass, I played MIDI bagpipes.
Oh.
I smuggled them into the set. I thought it would just...
heretic.
Good word.
I managed to get this drone thing going on, and I was controlling it with like the expression pedal, but I was just bringing in this big MIDI bagpipe. So I thought that was a crime against all music.
Well, the Egg are a very, if you haven't seen them, the Egg are a very kind of musically hijinks kind of act, aren't they? They kind of like to throw things in there to keep us on our toes. I remember seeing them. But they run clock off the drummer, don't they? They take the bass drum and it runs the clock for everything else in the show. Am I right in thinking?
Yeah, that's what they do normally. Sadly, Math wasn't there on that gig. He was in Turkey, so there was a Deppin drummer, a guy called Tony. But ordinarily, that's what they do. And it's really clever, because I've played with them a few times and using various MIDI devices, and it takes its... Yeah, and I take my clock from Math, who's... I can't remember the name of the software he's using, but he's constantly giving MIDI trigger, and so everything follows his tempo. He can speed up and slow down, so it's all... It makes it organic, and it also makes the arrangements completely on the fly as well, which is quite nice, given that the techno sound of it.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Certainly does. Sadly, not a lot of fun is not perhaps our first topic this week, but we feel it only proper to kind of discuss Steve Howell's great works. Obviously, Steve Howell has had a major impact in music technology over the years. You know, Akai Samples, Hollow Sun, all of that. I was sadly taken sort of ill suddenly last weekend and passed away very, very quickly, which is a big shock to everybody. He's an amazing guy, though. I mean, we've talked about Hollow Sun products in the past. We've had, you know, some really good... He's like the king of sampling in terms of looping and what have you. It's just a really interesting bloke. And we never got the opportunity to have him on the show, and I really do regret that now. I know you, Gaz, were quite a close friend of his, so, I mean, it must be tough times for you, but, you know, also perhaps some good memories would be appropriate at this time, so we can kind of send him off with a kind of... a sense of, you know, the stuff that he achieved, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a complete shock. Rob Puricelli
failed
sent
music,
me a message on Thursday, I think it was, to say that he'd been taken ill, and sadly by the Saturday he'd passed away from, I'm not sure what it was, but an illness of some form. And it was complete, for me, it was completely out of the blue. I was with him fairly recently. Horrible. What a shock, you know. He was such a character as well. I mean, for anyone who knew him, he's such a quirky character, such a quirky character. He would always be wearing, you know, tweed and brogues. He always looked really, he sort of
dapper,
had a
I
very
think is the
dapper,
word.
Yeah. Yeah, like a kind of sort of, dapper gent.
It's a great look in anybody, I feel.
Yeah, and his apartment was really nice as well. It sort of had the same kind of stylistic, maybe like 1930s kind of look about it all. And he had this big table in the middle, which he had his computers on, and he also had his .com modular as well off to the side.
Nice.
But it just looked so wonderful and so stylish, the way it all was in his in his room there. And he had a very funny outlook on the world as well, you know, very dry sense of humor. It was such a shock. We just started working on a project together as well, so sadly that won't see the light of day. I don't know what else.
I think one of the things that, you know, we should probably remember is, you know, for those of us who came up through the world of Akai and Akai samplers, whatever, he was responsible for a lot of the early sample libraries that kind of travelled with us through from S900 right up through to, you know, to later days when they probably ended up in ESX24 or whatever it is. I've still got a whole bunch of samples that I've, you know, that have come with me, big boxes of floppies that I've sort of ingested into my overall sample library, and I'm sure he's kind of responsible for a lot of those. It also had a lot to do with the GUI for the S1000, S5000, 6000, and Axis software. I don't know if anybody remembers that, but programming, certainly programming Akai samplers for live, that was absolutely invaluable to kind of set up very quick. Rather than be sitting there poking away at things, you can do it remotely via, I think it was, you needed a USB board from what I remember for the Akais, and the later Akais, the five and 6000. And it did a lot of basically, you know, great stuff there. And also, I don't know if you remember the Akai hard disk recorders. I don't know if anybody ever used any of those. They were kind of, I think we used them live for Golf Rap for a while. And he had a lot to do with making those. You know, did a whole bunch of things in terms of just.
Well, the last time I was with him, actually, I was telling him that I'd been looking for a Akai DPS24, which is the large. All-in-one hard disk recorder, but with a control surface. And his eyes totally lit up when I mentioned that, because I think that was one of the last projects that he'd worked on with Akai. And he was integral in the design of that, you know, the layout and the controls. You know, so when I told him that, I was kind of seeking one of them out, which I still am if anyone's got one. But he was... You know, he just his whole face lit up about that, and I think it's I think it's so interesting that he'd been involved in because he was originally involved in making sample libraries, and then got drawn in and started getting involved in into the hardware side of things. But there was a little coincidence on Saturday, because I was playing, as I mentioned earlier, with the Egg, and I mentioned. About Steve's untimely demise, and as we were getting ready, the guitarist pulled out. He'd only brought one effect with him to use, and it was an Akai Headrush delay pedal. And Steve had told me about that because that when that pedal came out, and I think there's been two versions of it, but with the version one, he I'm not sure to do with whatever they'd built it with. He'd realised that there was enough memory inside it to turn it into a looper, put a looper function into it as well. Which I'm not sure if at that point it had been a combined delay pedal with a looper function, but it was certainly one of the first. And so that looper was there at Steve's idea to put that looper there. I think initially it was met with a bit of reticence from some of the others in the company. But that's gone on.
A bit of adventurous coding. That's awesome. Absolutely awesome.
Yeah.
Rich, I know that you... I know that you were a big fan of some of the Hollow Sun libraries as well, because, I mean, we talked about them here on the show, haven't we? Have you actually had any dealings? Did you meet the man in person?
No, I never met him in person, but in our online interactions, he was always really nice and kind. And my heart goes out to his family. You know, all the usual mortality things come up for me about how it's all precious and we have to embrace every moment, and you never know.
Absolutely, yeah. Those are wise words indeed. I mean, I guess Mark also from, you know, you must have been a big Akai user. So I mean, a lot of him was in the stuff that we've used up for years and years, really.
Me?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up with S612, S700, S900, S1000, all of them. Without them, I wouldn't have a career, I don't think. So, I mean, they're like massively important because it made the whole thing affordable.
Yeah.
It made, I mean, one way I'd made it affordable before was to build something out of a ZX Spectrum. And it had like 4 seconds of sample memory, and it was kind of usable, but really unusable in terms of it wasn't polyphonic or anything. So suddenly having polyphony and access to like several seconds of sample sound and being able to do all that was like quite unbelievable. And those sounds as well, I mean, Well, the S900 had one of the best libraries ever, I think. And the way the S900 sounded was because it had that companding thing in it that worked a bit like DBX. It meant you could get like stacks of sounds in an S900. None of the other samplers kind of worked quite like that. So
no, you could get so many 99 samples, wasn't it?
I never met that man though, but I do know the name. I mean, the name's sort of, it's like, you know, he's one of the sort of folklores of our particular kind of, you know, what we do, isn't he?
Absolutely.
That name's been around forever. So
absolutely,
it is a bit of a shock because it's sort of, I don't know, it makes you think about your own, like it makes me realize I'm 51 and most of the time I haven't noticed that I'm any older than 5. Oh, I noticed there's a robot.
I mean, these things always do tend to make one reflect. Got much Akai heritage in your past?
Well, no, to be honest with you, my first sampler was a Roland S770.
Ah, yes.
I just went straight for that. I just went straight for that route because I just thought at the time they were more musical because of the filter on them and everything.
Yeah.
And so I went the whole route with that. I had an S770 and the SP700 playback version. And that's kind of my history with sampling really before I got into computers. So, but I mean, the HoloSun libraries, I mean, for years we've been using the definitive CP70 library that HoloSun did with Howard for Live to do No One Is to Blame and stuff like that. And more recently, I've loved the Music Laboratory Machine stuff. So, you know, yeah, it's just real tragedy. Someone so talented is gone.
Absolutely. We did see Atomic Shadow in the chat room, I think, there as well, who is one of the guys who, you know, Steve Howell has mentored and brought, you know, a lot of his sounds in, which we've talked about as well. In fact, Rob Puricelli, Failed Muso, has actually created a book of condolences on failedmuso.com. If you want to contribute to that, there's a lot of, you know, some resources. There's some video of Steve. So if you have never seen him in person, you can get a sense of the man. And lots and lots of comments. And I think the one thing is, you know, his family, as Rob said, have been kind of really sort of been given some comfort in the fact that all how many people were sort of touched by him and stuff. So I don't want to dwell on it too much, but, you know, rest in peace and enjoy your spiritual life from now on. And you know, I think that's kind of, it's great that he contributed so much to our community, and obviously very, very sad news. So let's move on a little bit. I'm not sure if this is anything much more cheery, but a lot more trivial, I suppose, in many ways. But only to some. I know, Rich, this was something that was you were very keen to talk about, and this is the news about the new Mac Pros are not compatible with certain of the Universal Audio cards. I've spoken to Universal Audio as well, but what's the issue that you came up against?
Well, there's a hardware incompatibility between the new Mac Pro and running most of their former card line in an expansion chassis.
Yeah.
And my problem with that is this, that they haven't gotten it together to offer a reasonable upgrade path for their customers. And some of these products that don't run on the new computer were sold new as recently as a year ago. And so it's not so much that I think that they've got some sort of evil intent in any of this. I just think that they've failed to provide a reasonable upgrade path for their existing hardware customers. And the reason why I think that's so important is because you can't run their stuff any other way. Excuse me. And if you have one of these cards, you've invested something in buying that software so that you could use it. So you're basically now stuck with selling your existing, if you want to upgrade the computer, which yeah, I'm not ready to do, by the way. But if you wanted to, you would have to then sell your card privately, knowing that its value has dropped because it's not future compatible, in order to then buy a new piece of their hardware to run your existing purchased software. And I just think it's incumbent upon them as a corporation to want to keep their customers happy. And I think that they probably, hopefully they will. I mean, but it's just, I think it's a shortcoming, and I wanted to see what other people thought about it.
Yeah. I mean, Robbie, you use, don't you?
That news has been around since the Mac Pros were announced. I mean, that's been on their website for about at least 2 or 3 months. But I mean, the thing that annoys me about it is that, like Rich said, it's a particular sting for people possibly who've got like quad cards. Because if you had the UAD quad, which was the top of the range, and quite a lot of people I know have 2 or 3 of those in their machine, and they hadn't thought to bother to move to the Octo cards, that card is not compatible. You know, so perhaps if you had a solo card, it's not quite as much of a sting. But if you've got 3 quad cards, like Rich said, that you may have only bought less than a year ago, I think it's a real shame that they haven't offered, like you said, some sort of way of at least trading in those UAD quads for Octos or something.
Yeah.
So you move forward.
Exactly.
You know, it's like the old thing we all talk about, you know, the Pro Tools in the past and always having to pay so much money. Generally, Universal Audio have been great with all that kind of stuff. But I think this time it's a bit of a smack in the face, that. And I know it's for hardware reasons, but I think they could do something for all the users they've got.
Well, just for those of you who perhaps aren't fully avail of the information, basically the new Mac Pro, which is the trash can one, uses a different, I don't know what FPGA, that's got something to do with the PCI bus, they use a slightly different controller chips or structure, and it's basically they're not compatible, the cards in the older generation aren't compatible with the new Mac Pros. You know, they said they're not actually thrilled about it at all, and they've been trying as much as they can, because obviously, you know, you could put it into a Thunderbolt chassis and what have you, but that, again, that's not going to work either. But it is worth saying that there is as at least some movement towards it. What they've been doing is showing there's an Octo promotion. So you can buy an Octo and you get $750 worth of UAD plugins, which is kind of, you know, which is great if you're not orphaned.
If you've got them all already.
But if you've got them all already, it's probably not what you wanted to hear. So, yeah, I guess it's a very tricky situation, because I'd imagine in a lot of instances what happens with the hardware side of things is there's probably not all that much money to be made on the hardware, and it's on the plugin. So to trade in and do the hardware is going to be very difficult for a company to swallow, because they've been shafted by Apple. But I agree, it's a nasty situation. Rich, sorry, you wanted to come in there.
Well, it is exactly as you said. Unfortunate situation, and I'm hoping that they'll come to grips with it and offer. All they have to do is offer a few $100 towards the upgrade to an Octo card to these people, and everybody feels like they've at least been acknowledged as customers. And when you do have a subscription service like that, where you're basically renting the software to run their cards, it makes sense for them to want to do that.
Yeah. I guess so. Maybe there should be some program for people who have, you know, X number of plugins or a lot of software already invested, should get a different deal to people who are just going up from, you know, the bottom. So you can either have, you know, X number of dollars on plugins if you're going up and you haven't already got some, but if you've already got like most of the range, it's not necessarily going to help you. But maybe there's another sliding scale. It just requires perhaps a bit more thought. Sorry,
Gaz. I've got another option is just stop using UAD. I was put into a mix project last week, so I spent a couple of days in a studio up in London, and we ended up stripping off. Oh, there was loads of UAD plugins on everything. Every time we took them off, the tracks just sounded so much better. And
well, that's not necessarily down to UAD. That's not really fair.
Hear me out. Those UAD plugins are so seductive. They're so sexy. The graphics of them—they look so, you know, like this is your magic. This is your magic plugin, and I think I'm being a bit facetious. This just happens to be a coincidence, because my experience recently with UAD was the more I removed them, the better everything sounded.
That could have just been down to the poor mix structure in the first place. But I would like to say at this point, you know, obviously, full disclosure, Universal Audio are an advertiser on the site, and I did contact them and ask them, you know, kind of for a comment on this, and they said, you know, they're kind of pretty gutted, and they, you know, they said, please let people that they're not thrilled about this, and it's been a really tough issue for them. I'm guessing at this time, you know, globally, I'm not saying that this is necessarily specific to UAD, but everybody is probably hurting in terms of financial turnover and what have you. So, you know, anything that's likely to kind of cost, I don't know, whatever it might cost, if you take 200 bucks times X thousands of users, it starts to mount up pretty sharpish. But yes, it may be that that could be revisited and they could maybe come up with another.
It's not too late.
I just
wanted to say it's not too late for them to step up and do the right thing here.
Sure.
But in reality, let's be honest, you know, like we've talked about before, how many people are rushing out to buy Mac Pros? It's going to be the new ones. It's going to be a long, long old kind of transition. And that is part of the hit of probably going to that system, like we talked about with Thunderbolt. But at the moment, there'll be a very buoyant second-hand market still for quad cards, etc.
And so Mac Pros,
If you're in a situation where you've got possibly like two quads, you could probably sell two quads and pretty much pay for an Octo at this time.
Yeah, that's probably true. Good. Nice upside.
Okay, good.
But yeah, okay. Mark, yeah.
I just want to say that I think that the problem isn't UAD. It's Apple. It's always Apple. I mean, come on. Like, you know, with the PC, there's always backwards compatibility. With all of these systems, there's backwards compatibility, apart from with Apple, who radically changed their hardware and then turn around and say, oh, sorry, that's no longer compatible, and shaft loads and loads of manufacturers. And they do it with the iPad, the iPhone.
Yeah.
Why did they have to change from that 30-pin connector to that ridiculous little 8-pin thing that nothing seems to work with? You know, it just goes on. It's just kind of, and they do it with all their laptops. They do it with all their desktops. And it's great to be on the leading edge of technology and to kind of get hold of the best and the fastest and to build machines out of that. But to then just like drop stuff off. So, and it's not even, you know, like leaving old technology behind. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's the rapidity that they do it with. It's like, I've got a six-year-old laptop in the next room that's incompatible with virtually everything now. If you've got Apple hardware and it's more than about 3 or 4 years old, you've had it.
I disagree there actually, because I've got our main computer here is more than 3 or 4 years old. It's probably 5 or 6 years old, and it runs perfectly fine. I mean, admittedly, I'm not trying to do
Mavericks.
I don't know whether it will or not. I don't care. I don't want to run Maverick, so it's really irrelevant. And to be fair, you know,
if you wanted to author iBooks.
Yeah, no, you've said this before, but I think the thing is, you know, with PC motherboards, you get incompatibilities with FireWire, you get incompatibilities with some USB devices. There are all sorts of other issues, and they're probably more difficult to figure out because they're slightly more random. So you get whether you get the Texas Instruments FireWire chipset means it'll work with some FireWire devices and other. You know, there's always going to be this, but I do agree. You know, when there's a swathing change, Apple don't have a great track record about this, but it's not purely Apple that you know that this happens to either.
Okay,
so
well, what about Logic Audio then? If you want to run Pro X, you have to run the latest version of the operating system, and if you want to load your old session in anything you did more than a few years ago, you can't load them in because they dropped all support for the old way of
I totally agree with you. I think, you know, the thing is you know, we have covered this quite a lot in the past. I don't want to kind of become too bogged down in the sort of Apple side of things, but yes, it's a main drag. I mean, ultimately, it'd be great if Universal Audio were able to extend something a little further than they already have that's linked to hardware rather than software, because for those people who've got a lot of quad cards, they've probably got a lot of plugins already. Anyway, so that said, let's now get on to the portion of the program where we have a message from our sponsor. So talk amongst yourselves a moment. Oh, that's not it. I want to press that one. Yes, Isotope Iris, of course. You may recognise this. Sponsor of the show. Iris, of course, has its roots in Sonic Talk, where the seed of an idea for a synthesizer from their spectral analysis of RX was kind of turned into a synthesizer, four oscillator synthesizer. Natural intuitive selection tools manipulate your audio visually. You can see an image of your sound, draw and select individual events, shape shifting, apply synthesis control to your selection, shape, morph new textures, warm lush filters, delays, or even lots of effects for each layer. Sound libraries is a mix of wood, glass, food, toys, voice, altered and prepared objects, as well as crazy modular synthesizers, pitch percussion with the Iris expansion patch. You can download a free 10-day demo of Isotope Iris today at isotope.com/iris. I think the sale's just finished, so I probably won't read that bit, but it really is a unique way of looking at sound. And of course, what we also have is the winner of a competition, which I paid a couple of weeks ago. We posted, let me see, I've got it here. We posted the Isotope Iris competition, which you need to tweet out. So if you're not a member of Twitter, you could join just for this, because, I mean, the odds are pretty good. And for some reason, I think it must mean the summer breaks. Anyway, the winner is, this week, they've won Iris, and it's somebody called Drew Arigardus, at Drew Arigardus, who tweeted, synthesize anything, and at Sonic Nick and Isotope Inc. And if you want to, we're going to do the same thing again this week. So if you want to win a copy of Iris, you certainly can. All you got to do is go join Twitter, tweet with the hashtag at Spectral Synth this week, at Sonic Nick and at Isotope Inc. Those are our addresses, so that it means that I can pick up, and I've got a little filter running so we can see who did it. And you can win a copy of Iris. And once again, we thank them for their continued sponsorship of the show. Right then. So, while I was at it, actually, a Sonic Talk listener, Chris, I don't know his surname, but I know he's renovating a 2CV and he's listened to hundreds of hours of Sonic Talk while he does it. He sent me a handmade Eurorack multimode filter, which I'm going to check out later. So I want to thank him very much for that. And yes, just thought I'd bring that up. So thanks very much, Chris, whoever you are. Right, here we go. This is the Slate Raven 2.0. Wow, what do you know? Stephen Slate here, Slate Digital. We've seen the MTI and the MTX console. They're very impressive touchscreen. Here, Stephen is introducing, telling us how awesome. It's a bit heavy sales to me, but what's really interesting about this is actually that the... is the idea of these macros, batch command system.
Okay, now we're going to add some more tracks. Well, with a batch command, we can add some new tracks and then even automatically name them with one button. So let's name all these tracks background vocals.
There are lots of examples of how batch, well, this is quite an impressive one.
When I select the entire drum track and hit the snap it batch command. So now this command is going to cut up each hit by the transient, then snap them all on the new grid, and then even fade each hit automatically. Let me say that again. In one button, this entire kick track will be sliced up by the transient and put on the grid and faded.
And there he goes. And also consolidate. I won't play the whole thing, but it seems like this is the version 2 of the Raven software, which is the control layer that works, integrates with the touchscreen over. In that case, it was Pro Tools, but it'll work with other things as well. And the big sort of sell of this is the idea of batches. So presumably there's some sort of macro recorder, you hit buttons and you can just, you know, do things like put the same plugin across any number of selected tracks, all sorts of track views and filtering, which does look actually pretty cool. I'm wondering if this makes any difference to anyone. It seems to be, you know, a lot of comments, people sort of going, actually this is pretty cool, this makes it more interesting. And I wonder what people thought about that. I'll start with maybe you, Rich. I know you're not necessarily ready for the large format touchscreen, but the idea of batch control and batch commanding is kind of, it's not new, but it seems to be nicely executed, right?
Absolutely. I have taken a lot of shots at Stephen Slate over his coffee table mixer, but this actually does a lot to make it more appealing to me, because what he's doing is and as you say, it's nothing new. I was using QuickKeys to do this kind of stuff years ago, but it's cool to have it built into the functionality of his coffee table mixer. And I was actually really impressed. I thought this was the coolest thing he's done with it so far.
That is interesting that you think that it's actually kind of got the extra functionality. But this brought up an issue for me, really, which is more to do with, why aren't we using, you know, this sort of stuff should probably be built into Pro Tools anyway, or any kind of DAW, or even into some OS level sort of system. Oh, I know. Yeah. Robbie, yeah. You sound
actually,
like...
The thing I like most about that video was that right at the end when he went on about the batch command for rendering out all your files, you know, from a mix, like totally consolidating all the little chunks and putting them all together, and basically making a session that can be taken into another DAW. Because the amount of time I spend at the end of every production running out files in real time, it's like watching paint dry. So I'm with him on that, if he can get that all working for Logic.
Yeah, I wonder. I wonder if this stuff is working out. I mean, it was all in...
Yeah, it's all Pro Tools, isn't it, at the moment? That's the thing.
So. I guess that's the biggest market. I mean, what was interesting is a lot of comments were going, come on, Avid, sort it out. You know, this guy should be working for you. You know, really. And that's the sort of thing that was that really came across. And they do sort of have a point. I know, Gaz, you're a big fan of customizing, you know, certainly Reaper and other things. Do you get into the idea? I mean, I when I start repeating myself, I think, is there a way I can batch this? Is there a way I could do commands? And I just can't help it. This sort of thing sounds really interesting to me, but there are alternatives, surely, than buying a 10 or, well, the big one, the MTX is 10 grand. This is pounds. And the MTI, which is 27 inches, 1,500 quid, which is actually quite reasonable. But there are other ways, surely.
Well, you mentioned Reaper, and Reaper has just got such awesome batch control. You know, you can do anything you want and create these incredible batch processes and whatever, anything you want. It's so deep, the integration of that. And, of course, it's brilliant because you can just assign any MIDI control as well as key controls to operate it. So, but they are, you know, it does take time to set them up and blah, blah, blah. And, well, you know, I think what's great with this Raven thing, though, is it just... I don't know. It just feels like he's really understanding the workflow now. It just, I have to say, a bit like Rich, actually, I think, you know, this, I have just kind of just gone, ooh, just because, you know, I'm always interested in workflow, in workflow improvements.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure, so what does it does? There is support for Logic X for the Raven, isn't it?
I think so, but I'm not sure how deep. Robbie, you saw it, didn't you? You actually did. You get a Logic X?
I went up to London and had a go on one, and it was still very fledgling when I've seen it. So I kind of thought I'm going to just leave it for a while and see how it develops, because obviously. Rightly so, he's very passionate about developing it on the Pro Tools platform, which is great. But I don't, you know, like Rich said, I don't want to buy into a very expensive coffee table for something that gets its support not quite get the same support. So yeah. I was going to give it a year, kind of just to see how it pans out, really.
I'm guessing that there's a great quote. Azure Head in the chat room said, batch create hit, which I quite like the look of. That's a button that everybody needs, right? Yeah. Mark, I know you're not perhaps the biggest fan of Mr. Slate.
I don't know, actually.
But this looks kind of cool.
I'm more his fan having watched that video. I mean, he's really thought about it and he's done some really clever stuff. What I thought of as, well, I could just go and buy, well, the route I'm going at the moment is I've gone on the PC and I could just go and buy a touch screen PC and I can start to touch the screen. And that's you know, I use an iPad and I know that I can do that on the iPad and I want to be able to do it on my main workstation. But all that other stuff. I spend hours creating like batch commands for things and actually having moved to the PC, there's loads of this stuff you can do on the Apple OS with automation and scripting that I don't know how to do on the PC, but I do know how to do some of it on the Mac. And if I, and like you, if I find things that I tend to do over and over, I'll try and create common ways of doing it, create batch scripts or create presets for channel strips, all that sort of stuff. But I know how to do that. And most producers want to produce music or record music or be engineers or whatever, and they don't know how to do that. And if he's creating these workflows for people and he's doing it as intelligently as that video seems to suggest, then he could be creating like, you know, what the system should be doing anyway. I mean, that is a very relevant point, that Avid should employ him and that he should be building that stuff into.
Well, there was also suggestions that he should just buy Pro Tools and develop, which, you know, is perhaps not as I'm sure he's probably not quite as his company's probably not quite as valuable as the market.
Overall impressed. I hadn't seen the point of it up until now, and I can really see a point. You know, I love his marketing, actually. I'm not so sure I like the idea of being finished in the studio and home before dinner.
Yeah.
That amused me.
Right.
I mean, exactly. Yeah, he's a clever guy. I mean, you know.
Yeah, and having your assistants deal with all the polishing of the screen to make it clean for the next day, etc. But I mean, this raises, you know, it's great, but it's one of those brilliant pieces of reinventing something that already exists and wrapping it into a product, which is what, you know, Apple have been doing for years with iPhone and iPhone. You know, batch control. There were a couple of things I actually found. What was it? There's a there's this one for OS X, which is what? This is Macro Recorder for Mac. This is kind of something that you can do, which will do screen cap. It's the sort of thing that people seem to be making viruses to take control of your computer and do key logging. But it's the sort of thing that, you know, in fact, is incredibly useful. I think there's also one for PC, Macro Recorder by Jitbit. Same sort of thing. I mean, obviously, you'd want to buy it from a reputable dealer because you don't want to be sending all that information.
What's the thing that's built into OS X? That's called Automator.
Yeah, it's Apple Script, essentially. It's an Apple. Because they've been doing that.
What am I doing?
I'm not sure.
It makes it like building blocks, doesn't it? It sort of almost makes it like writing stuff in a language, except it's very block oriented, the last time I used it.
Well, we use Apple Script a lot. In fact, this is Apple Script. All of that happens via everything that the show is controlled via Apple Script. You know, I Apple Script things to output MIDI to various devices for controlling the recording, for the switching, all of those things. You know, so it's all done. You know, it's a very useful thing. I mean, there are some things applications need to be very Apple Script aware to be able to do certain things like execute menu commands and all of those things. And some of them are a bit arcane, but it does raise that wider issue that, you know, this should be at OS level. It should be application level because, you know, basically, why do I need to buy £1,500 or £10,000 touchscreen to get this kind of automation? It's sort of irrelevant to the software. It should be happening, and but it seems to me maybe perhaps there's not as big an appetite as one thinks, because I mean obviously this stuff has been available. We're all professionals. Do we use it? No, we don't, you know, really. So you did actually. I take that back. I'm sorry, Rich.
Quite a bit.
and how come you don't?
In 1989, I was scripting software Alchemy using Quick Keys, controlling an EPS over SCSI. Between a Mac Pro or whatever the Mac SE thing was at the time, and in Sonic Samplers, I used to script all kinds of stuff that I didn't feel like having to execute 8 keystrokes to do 500 times.
I suppose so, but what my point is, you know, when you were saying like it would be cool to have these features that Stephen, how come you're not doing it now? Is it not possible, or is it just, you know, something that you moved away from?
Well, because the existing sets of keystrokes are actually fairly comprehensive to me. There are one of two things I used to use Quick Keys with Pro Tools on that I just haven't bothered to use it lately because Quick Keys itself became so unwieldy, and I just decided I didn't really want another layer laying over the top. But I think even when I was working with Mark in 2002, I'm pretty sure I was using Quick Keys. And
cool stuff, actually. I mean, that all that stuff you showed me, the putting stuff on grid, is mind-blowing, actually. I mean, it's like I didn't know how to do that stuff before, and being able to do it all and nudging stuff around and multi-track and all that sort of stuff. Very clever. You're a very clever man.
It's way faster now. It's way faster now. Thank you.
I'll have to come and watch you then. Maybe I need another lesson.
I've got new ways of doing it, and they actually sound even better.
Oh, well, cool.
Sorry, Gaz.
I was going to say, certain things I'd like to see in more available in other DAWs that you can map to Quick Keys. I really like one thing in Reaper is that wherever the mouse is hovering, without having to actually select the thing, just wherever the mouse is pointing at, you can sort of do various processes. Like, for instance, mute under mouse, you know, so wherever the mouse happens to be, so you can just drag boxes and mute or whatever the mouse is, just mute without having to click and there's a numerous other things like that as well. And I just wonder whether the selection, you know, when you're dealing with tools, if you're working with shortcuts and working with tools, I'm kind of banging on about Reaper here, really. When you use Reaper, you can assign like wherever the in the waveform, you can assign what clicking at the top part of the waveform does to the waveform, what clicking in the bottom of the waveform does to the waveform, what clicking at the right of the waveform. What, you know, you can really get, and you can assign very complex processes. Like, for instance, you can just sort of select a region of sound and then just adjust the automation.
Or the clip gain, right. Okay, all with sort of... A script.
No, not the clip gain, just the actual automation lanes as well, and just tasty, fast stuff that other DAWs, it just seems to be. I think every click you can save, then, you know, that does equate to, what's that? What's the old saying? A click in time saves nine or something?
Something like that, yeah. That sounds like eminently sensible. It'd be interesting, actually. Well, I think we might try and get an article together of how automator or keys can, you know, automation can help in music production, you know, because I think that would, that might be quite interesting.
I mean, even Ableton being able to assign different things to different keys, I find that incredibly helpful. Especially MIDI keys. I bought a MIDI footboard so that I can play and loop the guitar. So I don't actually have to put the guitar down or even let go of the guitar now. I just stamp on the next track and do it all with my feet, which has been a revelation to me, really. But anything that makes it so that you just have to touch one thing to do it has got to be good.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think all of these things, there just needs to be tighter integration. I mean, you know, computers can do so much, and they should be doing so much. They should be doing that's the one thing I find, certainly in video editing software, we use Sony Vegas. There's this whole way of getting into the program and creating these scripts that uses the .NET framework. I don't know enough about it, but you can do amazing stuff with that. And it really pains me to see people editing things by kind of going like this, going to a menu, selecting a whole thing down to here to a sub box, when it's just like one key command. So it just drives me mad. I'm thinking that's like 90% more time than that actually needs to take. You know, those are the sort of things that I try and help people, you know. I guess it's probably me that's probably more annoyed than they are, but they find that you can be so much more productive if you get away from your normal procedural way of using software and think, okay, I'm going to learn some key commands today. And just, you know, take 10 minutes to kind of go, right, there must be a way of doing this quickly. Because a lot of the time people don't know, you know, and you just go, oh, look, I could just do that. That's brilliant. I'll do that again. Or if I select all of those things and do that, fantastic. I don't have to do one at a time. I've done them all at the same time. All of those things are very, very useful, I think. Anyway, if you want to buy the Stephen Slate thing, you can head over to the various different, I haven't got it here, but there are distributors everywhere and you could buy them. I think you have to pre-order the MTX, which is the big, big one, which is still 1080, but the 27-inch MTI, which looks like the sort of thing I'd be interested in, is about 1,500 quid, if that's what you desire. Or you could buy some macro key software.
Where is it 1,500 quid, Nick? I seem to only be able to find it for $2,200.
Dollars or pounds?
No, pounds.
Where did I find it? I went rave... it was on guitarcenter.com. Showing it in dollars, showing it in US UK pounds, so maybe that's probably plus VAT.
You've got to pay import duty and VAT and everything on that, though.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, I take it back. It's still a couple of grand. $2,000 then.
Or put it in a big suitcase when you come back from the US.
Yeah, you're going to the US, aren't you?
Yeah, I don't think I've got any room for one of those, though.
No, perhaps not. Right, okay, let's see what we're... let's see what else we can bring to the show. That's a bit back to me. We could go to the BBC TV auctions. Anybody interested in that? Or we could do which kick drum mic, which I thought was kind of interesting, or the Focusrite Studio. Let's go kick drum mic. There is no video. There is no video to play, but it just struck me as it was a question that came up on Reddit, which there's a Reddit synthesizers group, by the way, which is actually. Doing very well. If you're interested in talking about synthesizers, go to Reddit and search for synthesizers. There's a group there that was contacted by the admin who told me to come and check it out, and I found a couple of topics there, and they seem very they're really kind of into being mentioned on Sonic Talk and you know us having some interaction, so do check that out. Kick drum mics, yeah. I was looking at, now let me see, where was it? There's this one I looked at, which has kind of looked interesting. This is an SE Electronics SEX1D, and it's got a titanium capsule It follows the form of all of their stuff. And apparently this is the... So this is actually a condenser. And I remember back in the day when I used to do a lot of live sound, you know, all recording, you'd have D112, which I think sound horrible, 421, or if you were lucky and you could get somebody to bring one in, Electro Voice RE20. And they were all dynamic mics, I guess. But that's changed quite a lot. That would speak for live. I mean, you wouldn't want to put something, you know, condenser mics weren't really gig-worthy when I was doing live sound, so you wouldn't really want to put one of those on stage. I know, Rich, you probably... I will go to you first. Sorry, that's not Rich. Just purely because you probably are recording kicks or have recorded kicks perhaps more than I have in recent years or days or weeks. What would you reach for generally, or would it depend?
Well, it depends. And we don't do a lot of kicks at Niall's place, so I'm usually out looking at somebody else's mic cabinet when I go to do them. But it just so happens that I was recently at Telefunken US, yes, which is very close to here. And while I was there having our precious U48 serviced, they were showing me a brand new microphone of theirs called M82, which is a dynamic kick drum microphone specifically engineered for kick drum and for broadcast vocals. It's an end address microphone that kind of looks like a U47, so it's a little deceiving. And they had a video, though I didn't hear this thing live, of it against about 7 or 8 other kick drum mics, including the Audix, the Shure, and a bunch of other ones, AKGs and such. And both the M82 and the Audix, I'm not sure if it's C6 or C7, I don't remember, but they both sounded wonderful. The M82 really did sound great. And so if I were buying one today, I might buy this Telefunken one.
Is it a pricey article or is it...
As I recall, no. It's in a few hundred bucks kind of range.
And it's a condenser, right?
No, it's a dynamic.
It's a dynamic. Oh, okay. Interesting. Gaz, you probably are recording, you know, real instruments as well. I mean... Do you generally, I mean, I know you're quite a big fan of, you know, minimal recording techniques, but I mean, presumably you would probably try and capture the kick drum at least as a discrete signal, right?
Yeah, I as I've gone on through, I'm really much more of the Glyn Johns kind of school of drum miking, a pair of overheads and a kick drum mic. But I've really gone off multi-mic drums, even though it does sound great. I just feel that you just spend a disproportionate amount of the time of the set. You know, if you get, you know, the amount of time you spend on a big drum mix and if you've got loads and loads of mics, I used to love that. But I just realized in the end, you'd spend sort of 3/4 of the time, you know, on the drum mix. Whereas if you get the overheads right and obviously the kick right, then that's great. So I change depending on a few circumstances. I tend to like the microphone to be outside of the drum, you know, outside of the kick drum, and therefore I like a kind of condenser on the mic, on the kick drum. I remember one time using a Neumann U67 on a kick and making sure that it was safely sort of off axis, but boy, that was a lovely sound. That really sounded good. I remember I haven't used one, but Audio Technica brought out the AE500, and that was quite an interesting mic in that it's got two capsules in it. It's specifically for kick drums, and it's got a condenser capsule and a dynamic capsule, and there's like a 5-pin XLR that comes off it that then splits, so you actually record the two separate signals off it, the dynamic and the condenser as separate channels, which I think is quite a good idea. I'd like to try that.
I've seen that. Again, you know, this titanium capsule kind of idea is supposed to be very... it just seems fitting, doesn't it? You've got this sort of really very strong diaphragm and you're putting it in front of something which is capable of massive air movement and what have you. I don't know that it necessarily follows that it would sound good, but I suppose it's robust enough to deal with it. I don't know. I've never tried a titanium capsule one, but maybe we'll get one in for review. I was hoping to. I know. What about you, Robbie? I'm guessing most of your kicks are of the electronic variety, but...
I mean, the very few times I ever get to record real drums, I don't pretend that I'm any expert, so I would go and get someone else to help me do it. Because I do it so rarely.
Yeah,
I'm too much of a control freak. I just want to be doing everything.
I know what you're saying. Actually,
so that it's totally outside of my sphere. But I do remember when I was in a band and we had one of those horrible D12s, how awful I used to think it sounded.
Yeah, it just sounds like wool.
The best thing the drummer ever did was buy a D-drum kit, in my opinion.
Good for you. In the chat room, it's Sonic6086 says NS10 is a pretty decent kick mic, and that's actually true. In fact, what you can do is you can take, like, it's an 8-inch speaker, I think, isn't it, or 7-inch speaker, and you can wire it so that the air that's moved, it catches the sub, so you turn that into a signal and amplify it, and the magnet, I think, amplifies the signal. And in fact, Yamaha built a kind of NS10 mounted kick drum mic that you put there, and that's the thing, you catch this, just the real woof to it. I know it sounds a bit lame, but that's assuming if you haven't got a U87 or a U67, which seems to be very much what people go, sounds lovely, but you wouldn't put that anywhere near someone who you really need to know what you're doing, because you don't want to break the diaphragm on those things, because that's going to cost you an absolute mint, right? I know. Mark, any thoughts on this subject?
Well, it's funny you should say that. I mean, the best drum sound I've ever heard was recorded by Ken Scott in Abbey Road, and he put U87 on every single tom. I can't remember what he used on the kick, though. And this kit went up, and I was like, wow, that sounds brilliant. And what have you done with the EQ? Nothing. It was just like all these U87s. I was like, what are you going to do if the drummer hits a U87? I was thinking, oh, my God. I mean, it didn't, but...
Yeah, you'd need to trust your drummer, wouldn't you?
So I would do that, because I just love the sound of that. But I wouldn't do it with, like, lots of them. I'd probably just stick a really nice mic up in the room and something that sounded as close to a U87 as possible, and record the drum kit sounding like a drum kit, because I want it to sound like how I hear it with my ears when I walk into a room and hear someone playing the drums. If I wanted to close mic a kick drum, I would either use a Seducer tape mic, which I might even stick on the skin,
right,
so it collects the trigger, and then I might even trigger sample with it. Or the other thing that's actually really brilliant for recording kick drums is a Tandy
PZM, a boundary mic,
$30 or $40 Tandy PZM. You put it on a bloody great big board in front of the bass drum, and with the PZM right in the middle of the center of the bass drum, basically, and it picks up loads of bottom end. The bigger the board, the better, because I think the bass frequency roll-off on those mics is proportional to the size of the boundary of the microphone, and the size of the boundary is basically how big a board you put it on. And you get a lovely sound from that. Really,
yeah,
lovely.
No, I've heard that. You are nodding sagely there, Rich. Do you use PZMs for that technique? I mean, that would. I guess you could use that for bottom end. I think you're muted, actually, mate. You can use it for basses, all sorts of things that just kind of pick up the extra low end, right?
Right. I don't use it, but he's absolutely right, and everything Mark said was right. So I was sitting here nodding.
The man. But it was very much the that, you know, contact mics were very much in vogue, and there was, because it was Tandy or Maplin's, Tandy or Radio Shack used to sell them. I remember they were like £25. I got one somewhere, and there was a modification you had to do with them to make them accept phantom power rather than eat PP9s, which is what they're, or PP3s, which is what you used to get through endlessly with those things.
Invariably, a lithium battery that's half the size of an AA that you can stick in it as well. That doubles, all right. Oh no, puts about 8 volts into it.
Right.
You don't want to have a PP3 hanging off the side of it.
Yeah. Well, you always forget to turn off. Sorry, go, Rich.
It was Crown that developed the PZM originally.
That's right.
The technology was then sold also through Tandy, much like Moog synthesizers. Moog synthesizers were sold through Tandy.
That's true. Oh, look, Gaz has, in fact...
Were they?
He's reached. There's the PZM. That's the realistic PZM, folks, modelled there by... By Gaz. What were they originally for? Weren't you supposed to put them on a table or something and they just pick up sort of the ambient sound? Was that the kind of... I think that's what they were originally designed for.
They were originally designed to eliminate this. If I'm talking over here, the sound changes, right? If I'm over here, the sound changes. Because the microphone's picking up my direct voice and it's picking up reflections from the things around it. So by making the microphone capsule very close to a reflective surface, it means that any reflections that come in from anywhere all get bounced into the mic by the same tiny, tiny little amount off. So it's reflected off that boundary plate underneath, which means that there's no phase relationships happening to cancel each other out. Like when I go over here, the stuff being bounced off the walls in my kitchen is cancelling out different frequencies in my voice as I move around. So it was designed so that you could move around and stand anywhere and it would still sound the same. That's the idea behind it.
So is it kind of similar to an Omni?
No, because an Omni is still picking up reflections from everything around it. The boundary mic's only picking up the reflection off that plate just underneath. So the microphone doesn't point out into the room. The microphone points right down onto the plate. So the sound comes in, hits the plate, bounces off the plate into the mic. So even if you've got stuff that's bouncing off the walls, it can never get out of phase with itself. Or you can't get any of those weird kind of phase shifting things happening, or less of it, because it's such a tiny distance between the capsule and the plate underneath.
Right. Okay. Well, I didn't know that. I might have to. I think I've got one somewhere. I might have to revisit it. I don't know if it still works or whether I have still got it, but I might check that out. Seems like something that you just tape on a wall somewhere and see what. I think they used to use them as audience mics in the club I used to work, where they did live recordings a lot. I seem to remember. So you'd have ambient mics for those.
Yeah.
Gaz, was that something you wanted to come in with? Sorry.
Only just for a period of time, it was the only mic I had, so I did. I recorded everything with it. I'd be singing into it, you know. I'd be kind of trying to sing into it quite close by and try not to get sort of wind noise onto it. But I used it for everything, literally everything. And funnily enough, those recordings I made, they sound all right, actually. You know, they've got a lot of presence, that's for sure.
Excellent. Now that's good news. Right, I think perhaps because it's now 5 o'clock, I think maybe the thing to do is, just in case you were interested, there's a Focusrite Studio console film. I think we'll probably leave that for now because I wanted to give Robbie a chance to show us his video, which I think I've put here. This is what you've just to run us. This is what you've been working on for your live rig, right?
So I've got one, and Howard's got a similar one, a bit different because he's got a big master controller in his.
All right, I'll play it now, and then you can talk us through it.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow, that's very futuristic. So that's a machine on one side and a push on the other. What's that there? Is that a monitor?
That's a Roland M48. It's the personal mixer for that goes with the V mixing system.
Ah, okay. Ooh, check it out.
And so it's got these LED strips. We've got LED strips built in, but they're special wireless.
You showed us, didn't you? So they've got RGB ones. They look pretty cool.
Yeah. So they're totally addressable via DMX wirelessly. So our lighting guy is going to be able to incorporate all sorts of different effects and lighting things that go with the whole stage lighting into them.
I'll tell you what it reminds me of. You know, remember those things on Tomorrow's World, which were like these big Perspex boxes with oil and water. So when you tilt them, you get these sort of wave machines going on.
Yeah.
I don't know where they came from, but that looks really cool.
It was a real baptism of fire getting this made in acrylic, because there's so many things you can't do with acrylic. Because, like, for instance, you can't cut square holes, because where the two angles join at the right angle, it's prone to splitting. So everything has to have little curves and ellipses and all this kind of thing. So it's been quite an interesting kind of journey to try and get them, one, light enough so that they can go in cases and not be over the flying weight, and two, strong enough that they're not going to fall apart at the first gig.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But I think they're going to work really well. We're just going to have to, roadies are going to have to be very careful with them.
They're going to be scratched, yeah. Don't put any stickers on them.
But the good thing about it is literally we can bring the rig straight out of the flight case and
play it again.
I'm going to have that wall of launch pads behind me as well. So just link one USB cable to that and power it up, and then a couple of looms come out the side and it's all wired up, ready to go. So
it's going
to be a lot less work than I had before as well.
And you're using the push live a lot, right?
Yeah, push is for all my kind of Ableton proper launching of scenes and clips and stuff like that. And then Machine, I've actually set up as a generic MIDI controller, because I actually went through loads of different MIDI controllers, worked wanting to find something that had full color pads, but was also velocity sensitive and had knobs on it. And there was nothing out there. And then I suddenly realized I've got machines sitting in front of me in the studio. And if you use their dedicated editor, you can do absolutely anything you want with it as a controller. So it's brilliant for that.
Ah, neat. Because the launch pads aren't velocity sensitive, are they? They're just...
No. So the launch pads I've got behind me, they'll be doing various feedback things, and also allow me to change filters and volume, which I'm assigning to them. And then I'll be able to then do all the clip launching from the push, and then kind of more bespoke stuff on the machine, like controlling Sugarbyte's Tornado and Stutter Edit and stuff like that, kind of more mashing stuff up.
Right.
And then the keyboard in the middle I use for playing extra keyboard parts and stuff. When Howard goes out the front, I can take over keyboards and stuff as well.
Wow. So, yeah. Very futuristic. Are you not tempted to maybe bring it back and stick it in your studio and
it's very nice. I must admit, I did. Once we actually got everything in there and turned it all on, I just stood there looking at it for about 15 minutes going, oh, this is so good. So, yeah. Yeah, very pleased.
Excellent. Yeah. And I don't know if anyone has any questions, because I know, Mark, you were very impressed. You said you were going to really give up impressed. Your gold star.
Yeah, I said I'd take off my little McDonald's employee badge. Mark is the sampling champion of the universe. I need to put that down for a bit and come up with something clever, because that was really cool. What's it made of?
It's made of opaque acrylic, 5mm acrylic.
Oh, okay.
So that's why obviously the light can get kind of diffused through it. Mm. So
yeah, it looks really nice. I mean, it just why don't more people do things like that? I mean,
I've been touring with all
kind of signature piece, isn't it? It's artistic and it's nice. It's just and I love the idea that it will.
So many controllers, and they've just been a mess because we've been touring with so many controllers. I've had a setup with all sorts of controllers on it and made of like this Meccano stand, and it looked kind of cool, but it was an absolute pain in the ass to set up, and there were so many cables, and it's all on display, and it's just so much more elegant, and like you say, kind of gives you a bit of identity if you can do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we've got a very definite aesthetic with the band, and the drummer's got an electric kit with custom acrylic pink cymbals, and it gives you a look that's different to everybody
else. If you go back to the 80s, like the Fairlight was so utterly iconic that anybody that used one just had this kind of, it had that kind of scientific appeal and something about it. And I think the coloured buttons on these new ranges of controllers that do like the pinks and the blues and all those things are iconic as well. But to like kind of, you've taken that theme and then themed it through the whole kit. It's just so cool. I really like it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So I had a question there and it's just completely gone. But I'm sure it'll come back at some other point after the show's finished, perhaps. There was, the chat room seems to be demanding that we mentioned the BBC auction. I've got a little video, actually. This is basically two guys who used to work at the Television Centre in England, Shepherd's Bush in London. Massive, great, sort of iconic building where it opened in 1960 and has just closed in 2013. And there's a phase one auction that's selling all the technical stuff, the backroom things like the control room stuff. And there's tons of it. Let's see if I can find... There's a PDF I've got here of... where is it? Oh, there he goes. The auction online, and it's starting the end of it. And there's some great things, some Coles ribbon mics. There's loads of furniture. There's some Colrec desks. There's all things. But I'll start with this video because these two guys went back and just sort of visited the building that they worked in for a while. As they call it, Auntie Beeb. The old auntie is what it's known as. I'll see if I can zoom this forward a little bit. That's the building.
I decided to go for a day out today, reminiscing around an old place I used to work, the BBC Television Centre here in Sheffield.
This is Jamie Langton and a producer friend of his called Neil Armstrong. Not the not the guy who went to the moon, I might add. but they had a tour around this. It's really quite sad because, I mean, you look at this sort of massively empty building. And if you're a UK or you maybe watch a lot of World Service, you'll kind of understand the, you know, the aspect of this. That's because it's sort of the home of many of our childhood films were made. That looks like the Blue Peter Garden. Good grief. Which, again, will mean nothing to anybody in the US. Rich looking very nonplussed. But just, there's these massive studios that just kind of, they're all going to go. I don't know what they're going to do with the building, but there's an auction of all the stuff.
Cool stuff collective.
I would dearly love to own some of the clocks and things, you know, to have here. I would like a big BBC On Air sign so I can put it outside. But it's interesting. I don't know, Rich, in the US, are there sort of large, not national, TV studios that are still operational? Most of those closed down. A lot of these things have kind of disappeared and turned into, you know, into much more viable commercially viable housing property than anything else, right?
I don't know that much about the video recording spaces. I do know, for example, that the 10th Avenue Hit Factory Recording Studios is now Hit Factory Condominiums. So I can speak a little bit to the recording studio spaces. But as for video studio spaces, I just don't know that much about it in the U.S. However, the building that you just showed was pointed out to me last year when I was in London driving by, and it was explained to me how it had formerly housed the BBC Broadcast Centre.
I would so love to have a wander around in there. I know, Gaz, have you ever been there and played?
Not for a long time, but there's a smell in that place. Lovely.
Does it smell like the inside of an old radio, by any chance?
Just a really evocative smell, and Maid of Vale's got the same smell as well. You know, that's BBC's audio recording studios, which I'm not sure what the fate of Maid of... I think Maid of Vale's closing as well, isn't it?
Well, I know Will Gregory went and did a session there with the Moog Orchestra a couple of weeks ago, so I don't know if it is closing. I mean, the thing is, they're going to need a studio in London, because, I mean, if they're doing lots of live recorded music, I mean, that's where a lot of the bands are going to be coming through, so it makes sense to keep that. I don't know what the plans are, though.
I remember there was some clear out of the BBC in Llandaff, the Welsh, BBC Wales' HQ in Cardiff, in Llandaff and Cardiff. And I'd gone there for an interview with my band, and we came out and we saw this skip. And in the skip, all this fantastic stuff was being put in the skip. Big Calrec preamps and all sorts of groove. Yeah, all sorts of groovy stuff. So we started just loading everything out of the skip into the van that we'd come in. Anyway, then all these security guards all came running down. Oh, no, stop, stop, stop. And then someone went in the road to stop us driving off. And they kind of, and we're going, but it's in the skip, you know. And they said, no. And then they said, the problem is with it is that anything that's got a BBC, has it got a power supply in it, and it's got like a kind of BBC stamp on there, then it's illegal for anything to be taken away. It has to go to this other place. Oh, and it was this whole bureaucratic element that you'd have to go through. And it was just to essentially get it from the tip. Got it.
Did you not manage to keep anything?
No.
Oh.
No. You could see the security guards were really pleased, you know, they had some...
That's something action to do. That's awful. Mark, you must have been to Television Centre in the past with the Durans, possibly, or other bands?
I have been to Television Centre on different occasions for different things. Yeah, and my partner, Gina, when I first met her, she worked in the BBC for years, actually. So we used to go to the BBC bar, actually, which is riotous, or used to be riotous. And also the BBC canteen, and I actually think that the smell that you smelled through the building was probably them cooking some
Scott dinners,
pea soup or something. I've been to the new one as well. I went to the new, there's a new building, isn't there, near Oxford Circus.
Oh.
I went there about a year ago, I think, and went all around there, but that's much more people sitting around at desks with computers kind of based than than any real. I mean, there are studios there, but it's just not the same kind of feel. I mean, it's everything's just got so small now, hasn't it? I mean, that PDF with all those racks and racks and racks and racks of gear, which are basically modems or ways of sending bouncing radio signals around the country. All that stuff is completely obsolete.
Look at it. Look at all of that.
Shame
stuff
about the Calrec preamps, though. I mean, it is just. There's so much red tape in the BBC. You try and get...
Well, it's publicly owned, I suppose, isn't it? So it's probably... they have to dispose of it correctly or whatever it may be. Look at that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's probably some huge health and safety thing around every single thing as well, you know.
Oh, look at all those DAT machines. Jesus. CDs.
Extraordinary, isn't it, really?
It is. It's just those clocks. Ah, that's the one I want. I want that one there.
Yeah.
That thing.
I'd quite like some of the microphones.
Yeah,
there's a good range of microphones on there.
Robbie, you been to Television Centre or any of those places with you? Must have.
Yeah, I've been there in the past, yeah. I mean, yeah, but like Mark said, I looked at that gear and I just thought, how much of this gear is of any use to most people? I mean, it's like loads of stuff that just looks like it's out of some old 1970s sort of sci-fi film in some control room somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you think? Do you think they'll actually make a lot back from a lot of that stuff?
I have no idea. I think the mics and the Calrec desks will probably be over
stuff.
And there'll be a certain memorabilia aspect to it.
I guess.
There we go. Look, that floral sofa. Not sure about that. but, you know, you could have a little piece of BBC chair. Look, some Herman Millers there. And all this stuff. Yeah, what's that? Oh, look, a load of recycling bins. Oh, it's just, a lot of it's going to be tat, isn't it? But presumably this is phase one. I don't know what's going to be happening in phase two, but maybe it'll be something great. But it just feels a little bit of a shame, I suppose. But, as with all of these things, they all move on and they do get broken up. I mean, you know, obviously, I mean, I guess, Rich, you've got a load of modules that kind of probably came from, you know, larger Neve consoles or whatever, you know, that's just the way that things work. Did you have I'm not sure. I don't know whether you did, Rich, or not. Did you got some Neve stuff, or is it all in the BCM format?
We have some vintage Neve stuff. He has some vintage Pultec stuff. We have API EQs, things we've gathered over the years.
Presumably
a Neve console.
Yeah. Ah, right. Okay. Presumably some of those things are actually kind of would have been bits of larger format consoles or what have you that tends to happen with a lot of these things, like certainly with Neve preamps and EQ sections and what have you, usually are taken from larger pieces that are no longer.
It's possible. They appeared in my life generally in these custom built racks that had been assembled prior to my arrival. So I don't know exactly where they came from. Well, actually, the APIs, I do know from whom we bought them, but I don't know where they came from before he sold them to us as is.
Well, anyway, that sort of probably brings us to the end. I've got a...
I was just going to say, I noticed somebody said in the chat room that they'd like to have some stuff from Blake 7, but the way I remember it is that all of those props and stuff just used to be kicking around the BBC, rotting, and nobody really looked out for them. And I just think overall the BBC have a pretty poor lack of foresight with some of these things, and they'll probably, no doubt, sell off loads of things that they'll suddenly realise in 10 or 15 years' time were really important, and then they'll try and get them back. Like Doctor Who episodes. Let's just throw all the tapes away. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, right. Only cost a few hundred thousand each episode to make. Why would
we
need to keep
loads
the tapes?
There's loads of missing episodes, you know? Like, it's just... I don't know. All that red tape.
Somewhere.
Sorry?
Yeah, probably end up in landfill.
Yeah, they are. It's terrible.
When we did the remasters of Howard's back catalogue, we found out that loads of Warner's remasters literally ended up in some landfill by the side of a motorway somewhere.
Yeah, the RAN ones were in a drain, literally. Like this big kind of wet drain where they all got... EMI had just kind of jammed them all, which basically a storm drain kind of thing, which was like their kind of dumping ground for things they didn't think were important anymore. So,
wow.
well, moldy and melted.
What can we say? But I really do have to bring things to an end, just because I've got some more stuff to do. And because of my new form, I have to drink three or four of these a day. And I have been, and I need to leave quite soon. I have matters to attend to.
Join the club. I'm on a juice fast.
So I want to say, well, we'll go to you and your juice, Robbie Williams, yeah. Robbie Bronneman. What the hell am I thinking? Did it again. Thank you very much for joining.
I don't know. I had his money and his looks and everything else.
Yeah. But he hasn't got one of those neat rigs, though, has he?
No, exactly. Yeah.
So, Robbie, thank you very much for joining us. Sorry.
He hasn't got a modular synth.
No, he might not do. Anyway, thank you very much, Robbie, for joining us. Really much appreciate it. I hope we can have you again on soon. I know you're off on tour, but that's just the way it goes. Yeah. Whenever you can. So thank you, Robbie.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
So, Rich Hilton, thank you for joining us as well and sharing your thoughts on our variety of topics. I know in the summer things tend to get a little slow, but not for you. You're busy, 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 busy. So I hope you have a little time to rest between your hectic schedule. Thank you for joining us, mate.
Thank you very much. I always enjoy it.
And Mark Tinley over there. In a sunny part of the country, because it's certainly not sunny here. Anyway, thank you for joining us.
Somerset.
Oh, that's right. You are quite near here, aren't you? Yes, I forgot about Somerset. That. Anyway, yeah. Thanks for joining us, mate. And you're very welcome. We'll speak again soon.
Indeed.
And Gaz Williams, there in Bristol, gazwilliams.me. You can find out more about Gaz. Thank you very much. And stay tuned. We've got some more Gaz coming up on Sonic State, which we filmed quite recently. So look forward to that. Anyway, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
So that's it for this week. Remember, if you wanted to try out... my chair seems to be sinking. I think I must have lost some gas in my what's it? My valve. Yes. Thank you very much for watching. I also want to say thanks again to Chris for the donation to the modular. Also, thank you to Isotope for sponsoring the show. And do check out failedmuso.com, where there's a book of condolences if you want to contribute something to the sort of outpouring of feelings towards Steve Howell's passing. So thank you very much. That was Sonic Talk number 362.